For much of our country's history, African Americans have been in white America's kitchens, preparing, serving, and even inventing meals. The history is told in a new book, The Jemima Code, Two Centuries of African American Cookbooks. It's not a cookbook itself, but the story of 150 African American cookbooks dating back to 1827. Over the decades, that culinary history has informed the times and vice versa. The author is Toni Tipton Martin. I spoke with her yesterday and asked her about that title, The Jemima Code.
It refers to that in the late 1800s, a couple of guys who wanted to sell more pancake flour constructed an image of an African-American woman cook who they named Aunt Jemima, and they composed her image out of a bunch of different characteristics associated with African-American women, some true and some not, and therefore created a way of speaking to white people one way and speaking to black people another way about food and the role of women in food prep.
We should point out, by the way, that the gentleman you speak of, we're doing this in St. Joseph, Missouri, so there is a local connection.
There absolutely is.
But an Aunt Jemima or Jemima preceded that. That was something that was immediate post-war, wasn't it? There was Jemima minstrels or blackface acts, that sort of thing, called Jemima, Aunt Jemima.
Right. So these two guys, the legend is that one of them attended a minstrel show during which he saw an African-American woman being portrayed in blackface cooking. And I believe she was making pancakes. And so once he and his partner got together, they decided that was an excellent marketing tool for them. And so not only did they construct this myth around these women, but at some point during the World's Fair, they decided that it might be a smart idea to hire real women to portray this idyllic figure. And so they hired a woman to portray a slave in New Orleans, and she told her story about making pancakes on the plantation. It was quite entertaining for folks at the fair.
One of the women who did that was the grandmother of Michelle Norris, who works for NPR. And Michelle
That's
has written
correct.
About that and talked about what a demeaning thing this was for her grandmother. And that's why I asked the question about use of the name Jemima in the title, because so many African Americans find that demeaning.
That's absolutely true. So the point of the code and the book for me as an African-American woman is to demystify the image of Aunt Jemima, not to tear it down. As a matter of fact, there have been calls for that, for us to completely disregard her. But as a food professional, it's more important to me that we reclaim the values that really did exist in these women and their lives. And the starting place for that, for me, begins in biblical scripture, and that is the use of the name Jemima. And Jemima was not a derogatory name at all.
Well, let's talk now a little bit about the book. You're really dealing with about 150 cookbooks written by African Americans over the last couple of hundred years, actually. Give me a little more detail about how you went about this and what sort of material you've included. It's a little bit light on recipes, I note, but a lot of history.
Yes, it is. The recipes, we've intentionally steered clear of recipes just to make that point even stronger. So I'm not doing culinary demonstrations, for example, because there is so much really important messaging in this book that I didn't want to get us distracted in surveying and understanding recipes. But I was a reporter, essentially, on a story. I was looking for my grandmother in African American or in Southern food history, and I wasn't finding her. And when I did, I found degraded images of African-American women at work. And so I started looking for first-person opportunities, right, to hear their natural voice. And so at some point, cookbooks became the mechanism through which I thought that would be a great way to have a first-person encounter with these people who many of them had already passed on. So I used a bibliography that is online at the University of Alabama, and I used it as my shopping list, essentially. And I searched for cookbooks for a great number of years in antique bookstores. And the real turning point in the project, what really solidified cookbook collecting as the evidence that I would be using, was the onset of the internet and the ability of these stores to post their inventory online.
What are some of the things that you learned that struck you about history as you went through these books and these histories?
There is the question of why do I spend so much time looking at the South and Southern women's history in order to provide some context for these books. And we all are aware that not everyone in the United States was slaveholding. But that's where the records are. So I was able to learn from the very beginning about black cooks as proficient managers. They were supervising their environment. They would have to manage children of enslaved who would be serving in various capacities of kitchen work.
One of the things that must have been taking place, because in so many cases they were cooking for whites, is the fact that they probably had to make concessions for that. They were really cooking for a different taste, if you will.
Yeah, and I can only imagine. One of the things that became very evident to me early on in this project was the incredible memory that people who cannot read or write would have to practice in order to manage recipes in the big house where they would be cooking with ingredients that they don't traditionally or have normal everyday access to, and then going back to their meager existence in the slave village and producing food out of their ingenuity, their African history, and working all of that together with the foods that they would find in the natural environment.
Were there favorite ingredients, favorite recipes, if you will, that just keep coming again and again over the decades?
There are. And what these recipes really represent are the ways that African-American cooks and chefs prepared food when the resources permitted. So we hear quite a bit about African-American cooking being soul food. And I am certainly an advocate of maintaining and preserving the terminology of soul food. But soul food existed for a very limited period of time during the 1960s when African-Americans were claiming their rights and applying terminology like black is beautiful and soul to soul music, to soul dance, to soul food. And so they carved out a niche for themselves, associating the ingenuity and the creativity that was required to cook in that cabin, as I described. But there's an entirely different side to African-American cooking that is very seldom talked about, and that is the food that they cook at work. I like to say that today we honor celebrity chefs for the food that they cook every day on their TV shows or in their restaurants or essentially at work. But African-Americans have somehow not been able to enjoy that same level of status. Our cooking has always been defined and marginalized as just the food created in the slave cabin. And that's not been a fair representation. So these dishes run the gamut. They are caterer dishes. Dishes that would be lovely and wonderful in a chafing dish. They're foods of the middle class, the African-American middle class. So there's lobster and very few foods from the Southern canon exist in many of these books. And there's also a representation of regionality.
Well, I'm interested in the period between the immediate postbellum time back in the later 19th century and today. What about the time in between from, let's say, 1900 or 1920 to 1950, for instance? How did that change? Was there an evolution?
There was an evolution at that time. It's a great question. As African-Americans began to carve out their own lives in post-Reconstruction time, there was also this backlash that occurred in the white community, which is how we arrived at the state of Jim Crow and so many of the Klan activities, right? And so as that, the more independent African-Americans got, it seemed like it enraged those certain groups of white people even more. And the way that the African-Americans were getting that independence, many of them, was through food, working as caterers, domestics, but also being educated in the domestic sciences at Negro colleges, which we now call historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs.
We are talking with Tony Tipton Martin, the author of The Jemima Code, Two Centuries of African-American Cookbooks. We'll be back with more conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. We are back now with Tony Tipton Martin, the author of The Jemima Code, Two Centuries of African-American Cookbooks. Tony's going to be at Left Bank Books in the Central West End tonight at 7 o'clock talking about her book. Now back to our conversation. Is there a thread that you can trace from the early days of your research to the present time through these cookbooks, a single line connecting the dots, to use the current jargon?
Yes, I can. And that is the major piece of the code, and that is that we cook with a natural instinct, that we are not professionally trained, didn't practice and learn our crafts on the job, or develop and hone our skills on the job. And so during that 1930s to 40s period, there was an outright description of the cooks as having a natural instinct or cooking with some kind of mysterious voodoo-type magic. In previous generations, the slaveholding women would write and record their cooks and their capabilities as just naturally gifted and ingenious. And that residue still sticks on many of us today. We find it difficult to get our books published, to be taken seriously as classically trained chefs. We certainly are not represented well in network food television. And I think that's largely because we're still being relegated to this idea that we don't perform classically the way that the other parts of the industry do.
If you were asked as to what makes African-American food unique, what would it be? How would you synopsize or capsulize that?
Well, that's always the most difficult question, and those of us that do this work find ourselves stumbling to some extent over that question. Because what it really hints at is what's the difference between soul food and Southern food. And what Leah Chase in New Orleans said once was that ours just tastes better. There is a nuanced seasoning difference, which derives out of that African practice of using peppers and strong flavorings to especially once the enslaved, were here in the United States, then they were dealing with inferior products and supplies, and so they would have definitely been trying to make palatable foods that wouldn't otherwise necessarily have been something one wanted to consume. So we have found ourselves consuming far too much salt and sodium and a lot more fat in the diet. And we no longer have to do that. So some of what we need to start to transition people out of is the idea that that's because grandmother made it that way because of the quality of the ingredients she was working with, and we no longer have to do that. So seasoning, I would say, is the largest variable. And then I guess if I'm going to get stuck in my own words about the mythology of natural instinct, I think what people were seeing as natural instinct is an expression of love. To cook for someone is an expression of love for them. And we have completely lost that in today's day and age. We've turned cooking into slaving in the kitchen. It's hard work. You need to go to the grocery store and make sure that it's already pre-chopped and prepped for you, because that's not the part you want to do. You just want to get it on the table quick. And there's a therapeutic release. There's a, when you're cooking and chopping, and those aromas are coming up off of the cutting board, and smelling the changes in the beef as it becomes more and more done in the sautéing process. And we've completely lost touch with that intuitive part of cooking.
You're making my mouth water.
Good. I'm glad about that.
Next question would have to do with you as a student of history and the differentiation between studying history, as it were, through food as opposed to other aspects of our culture. How different is it?
Well, it's quite a bit different to be studying a subject through the eyes of a journal, through the eyes of journalism, as opposed to being a historian. I am not a scholar by any means. I maintain my reporter credential. And so I was looking for answers as opposed to pursuing a thesis and looking for evidence to support that thesis. I was just pouring through every possible resource I could find. So originally, when this was not a book about books, it was a book about people and their practices. I researched everywhere.
I have one final question for you. I'd like to take us back to where we started, and that is with Aunt Jemima, the iconic Aunt Jemima that most of us are familiar with, thanks to Quaker Oats. That logo was changed not too many years ago. Your thoughts about that? It was modernized. Was that an appropriate thing to do? Was that something that should have been done perhaps earlier?
Well, it was done earlier. One of the books in the collection describes their approach, the Quaker Company's approach to book publishing without her present at all. And so they've, as society has evolved, then the image on the package has evolved. But she, the code, what is encoded in her imagery for me, is that she speaks of quality. And we did go through a period in this country of just putting black faces on all kinds of products, perhaps as satire and degrading of the people. But you cannot escape from the fact that you're using that black image to say this represents quality. And that's where I choose to appreciate that imagery. Whether they take it off the package now or leave it on the package, for me, as long as we as a people have a different respect and appreciation for her, then whether she stays there or not doesn't really matter. But what matters to me is that we all embrace her various characteristics as we find them exposed in the Jemima Code, and then choose that character as one from whom we can learn. And I will share this with you as we wrap up about my eagerness to be in St. Louis, of all the other sites, the cities that I'm going to. The comparison that I make of these individuals to what's happening not far from you in Ferguson is the fact that these kids that are uprising about Black Lives Matter have touched on something that I'm touching on, and that is that we now know these boys by name. We used to be able to just sweep them into one category and say they shouldn't have had their pants hanging down or they were gang members or something. But black people have known police aggression was existing since the Klan was practicing it. But now we know their names, and we can no longer just ignore them. They're individuals, and we can learn from each of their experiences as we teach our sons how to behave in the street and as we teach policemen how to encounter them as individuals. And that's what my ultimate goal for this project is that we treat one another as individuals and perhaps bring down some of those prejudices and barriers that continue to plague our society.
A lot of people in this community think the same way, Tony Tipton Martin. Thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to seeing you a little bit later today in St. Louis, and I'm sure it'll have a nice crowd. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to being there.
That's Tony Tipton Martin, author of The Jemima Code, and she will be appearing at Left Bank Books in the Central West End to talk about and sign her book tonight at 7 o'clock. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll take a look at an exhibition marking the 25th anniversary of the Soulard Fine Arts Building and the concert opening Big Muddy Dance Company's 5th anniversary season. Also, in the next installment of Soundbites, produced with Sauce Magazine, he'll talk about the ongoing farm-to-table movement with chef Anthony Devote and a local farmer. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the role expanded early childhood opportunities can play in the future of our region and about the new 24-1 movie theater in Pagedale. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.